tying it. Tell him the Lord needs it. Okay, maybe that doesn't sound like too big of a deal, but I grew up in Texas, and I learned all about what it means to go take another man's horse, especially without asking. You just don't do it. But this is why you two go in there, do this, and then some other things are going to happen. So they brought it to Jesus, threw their cloaks on the colt, and the people honor him as he comes in, spreading their cloaks on the road and all that kind of a thing. And they shout, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." And it's a great story. Jesus, of course, being the featured person. So he enters Jerusalem for the very final week of his life, just like Zechariah had predicted back in 520 B.C. And it's important because that was such a key element in this triumphal entry, because Zechariah had prophesied that 5 centuries earlier. It had to happen. "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." Now, had Zechariah not been so specific 500 years earlier about actually riding a specific kind of animal, then maybe it wouldn't have been nearly as important. But Jesus knew the prophecy. A lot of people knew the prophecy. So he says in his mind, okay, it's time to fulfill Zechariah. You two go and find a colt. And so they do. Did they know why? No. Just that the Lord told them. So they procured the colt. And to fulfill the triumphal entry, he had to have somebody. In this case, two somebodies or nobodies, because they're not named. Go and provide a key prop for this story. It had to be something that fit the description that Zechariah had given. Where did they find it? Well, we're not told that. Who was the owner? We don't know. That's another nobody, isn't it? Someone who just happened to be living in a certain area of Jerusalem, so that when these two men walked through, it was his colt that they saw. Who was he? Don't know. He didn't even get to walk center stage. From over here, he has to say, "Hey, what are you doing with my colt?" Say, "Well, the Lord needs you." We don't hear any more out of him. So we don't know who the owner was. We're not sure who these two men were. But why did this guy allow strangers to take away his colt? Don't know. So here's a nobody about which we have almost no information. But how important was it to fulfilling this 500-year-old prophecy that this guy have his colt and two disciples come in and take it away? This was the key prop in this whole story. And he doesn't really even get much credit. So the point is, this insignificant man played a significant role in fulfilling a 520-year-old prophecy. But we pay very little attention to him, because all the attention goes to Jesus coming in, all of the people shouting and praising him as their king. That's where all of the action takes place. This almost is like it didn't happen. But he was so important to fulfilling that prophecy. So how important was his small role in that dramatic entrance of the Lord? Why, it was key. It was really important. What recognition did he get? Well, besides the scriptures recording that's what happened, none. Do we know what his name was? No. So what do we learn? Well, let's look at our next presentation. The hungry assassins. Remember that story? Watch 40 terrorists ensnare themselves in their swear now, pay later desperate conspiracy of death. Sounds exciting, doesn't it? Starring Paul, the troublemaker. The Fraternity of Hunger. And a special appearance by the Roman Legion. A lot of folks in this one. But who's the primary, who's the big star? Well, the Apostle Paul, of course. And then this group of 40, can't miss them. They've got such a huge part in this story. And so let's read a little bit of it in Acts 23. The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy, bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We've taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petition the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case. We're ready to kill him before he gets here." Sounds like a lot of modern day political shenanigans, doesn't it? But that he was caught in that. And he's the key player. But something happened. When the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul. And then Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him." And so he took him in. He told the authorities about the plot he had overheard. And I've always thought a little bit curious that he's described as the son of Paul's sister. Why use five words when you could just say he was Paul's nephew? I don't know. But it just happens to be in the right place at the right time to overhear the plot. He runs in and tells his uncle, then he's ushered into the commander's. So, here's the deal. Paul, the main star, is in trouble. A group of 40 men, we know what they're doing here, and it looks really bad until we learn that a nobody, maybe his name was Don Walker, a nobody heard the plot, told Paul, and he took the information to the authorities. Now, how much more do we hear about this son of Paul's sister? Nothing more. It's like he hears of the plot, he comes in from stage right to center stage, tells his uncle and the authorities, and it goes out. And that's all he does. While Paul and the 40 men and the Jewish leaders and the Romans have to get involved in it, all that has to take place. So for Paul, at least, it was a pretty intense drama. Well, who is it that learned of the conspiracy? What's his name? How important was it that he heard that story and relate it to Paul and the others? Was that a significant part of this whole story? Well, obviously so. So who is the hero of this particular drama? Well, it's not Paul. He's the star, but he's not the hero. And it's not the centurion with his 470 soldiers, though he maybe could have taken credit for saving Paul's life, but it wasn't him, really. So if it's not Paul and it's not the big shot Roman soldier, then it has to be this insignificant person with a role so small we don't even know his name. He's the hero. That's not the way dramas usually work. It's usually the main guy who winds up being the hero. But in this case, of course, all the rest of the attention focuses on Paul. But the key pivot point in this whole story was the Don Walker, who heard the plot, came in, said his line, and just left. How important was he? Did he get any recognition or thanks that we know of? No. So what do we learn from this story? Coming later this summer, the Last Supper. You ever heard of that one? Star, Jesus Christ. The disciples. And a lot of important things happened in this story. Shortly before he goes out to the garden, is arrested and crucified. One of the biggest stories in the Bible. So let's look at a little bit of it. On the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, Jesus' disciples asked him, "Where do you want us to go and make preparations to eat the Passover?" So he sent two of his disciples, telling them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. Say to the owner of the house he enters, 'The teacher asks, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' And he will show you a large upper room." And so they left and they did that. Biggest story, short of the crucifixion and resurrection, that we have. Eating the Passover, which itself was so significant particularly knowing what Jesus did in that Passover, giving them his bread and his blood, setting up what we know as the Lord's Supper, washing the feet, the exposure of Judas, so many important things leading up to the garden story. But to set it all up, you need some nobodies. It was his last night. He was about to do some extremely important things, as we've just talked about. But first, he says to two of them, you go out and secure a place. You go find a place. Well, how will we know where it is? Well, look for a man carrying a jar of water. Okay. That shouldn't be too hard to spot. Follow that man, and then when he walks into a house, say to the owner of the house, where's my place? Where's my room? Who were those guys? How important were they to setting the scene for all those marvelous things that were about to happen in that upper room? Well, now there's a blank line. I don't know what that means. I think it was, who were they? Who were the two? Who was the jug carrier? Who was the owner of the house? And how important were they to the rest of the story? They were critically important. It's as though they just come in, set the scene, and they leave. So that Jesus can take over and do all those wonderful things. So the point is that Jesus and the 12 were the stars of this story. But a nameless man carrying a jug of water was used to find another nameless man who owned a house with an upper room. And then we never hear of them again. They're just there. But it's easy for us to pass them over because of the grandeur of the rest of the story. What recognition or thanks did they receive? Well, again, none that we know of. So what do we learn? I mean, we've looked at a bunch of examples so far. Let's do one more. You're familiar with Hebrews 11, and these people are actually named in that chapter as being great heroes of faith, and we know their stories. But it's not those that are named as great heroes that I want to look at just for a minute or two here. It's, you see that arrow up there says, and the following. So you have those who are big enough to have their names written out for us on the marquee. But then there are a bunch of others who are not named. They just get some descriptions. And when you read the descriptions of what they accomplished, it boils down to some folks who made heroic choices, even though we don't have any idea who they were. They're nobodies, in the sense that we don't know. We know some people did these things. Common people with no face for us, no name for us, no applause, and in many cases, no escape. Because many chose torture and death and ill treatment and desperate living situations because of their faith, but they're not named. They're not listed in the credits. Scary stories there in that chapter of sacrifice, brutality, murder, suffering, torture, death, by a lot of nobodies. We know the names of the stars, but there were so many others, Don Walkers, who did their part and did their part and did their part and then just walked off, never to be heard from again. And all of them just grouped together in this relatively short description of so many unnamed nobodies who testify to the greatness of true faith. How did they do that? And why did they do that? Well, we could talk about both of those for a good while. But why were they not even identified for us? Well, maybe that would have taken a lot more pages than the writer of Hebrews was interested in writing. But the interesting thing is that there are so many of them included in the grouping that maybe we ought to be learning something from them. We tend to look at the big names, the names we know, the famous people, the stars, the ones that get the recognition and the applause. And we often overlook the little people who are doing little things that make the big people look even as big as they are. Unnamed heroes. So what shall I say? I don't have time to tell about Gideon and all these others there who did all of these marvelous things. And so many others whose weakness was turned to strength. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured, refused to be released, so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging. Others were chained and put in prison, stoned, sawed in two, put to death by the sword, went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. And that's interesting. They did such great things that it says the world was not worthy of them, but yet, where are their monuments? Where are their statues? Where are the special days on our calendar where we honor them? They're not there. A multitude of Don Walkers, a day at a time, an event at a time, striving to serve the Lord regardless of the circumstances, and in many cases, no doubt, not understanding why they were having to suffer the way they were suffering, but determined to play their role, as small as it might have been, in God's scheme of redemption. So many people, so many very hard, difficult choices, so many incredible heroes, so many actors with little bitty roles, of whom we know nothing else. Just a brief description. The point, of course, being that they were actors with small roles, not named, but used by God to teach a great lesson about normal people who made extraordinary choices in order to serve Him. Normal, everyday people making abnormal, not everyday kinds of choices. So who were they? We don't know. What monument honors them? To my knowledge, there is none. What special days are celebrated for them? None that we know of. So why did they make those incredible decisions? Because they had a part in the work of God. How could they do what they did? They were dedicated. Beyond any question, beyond the danger of any circumstance. So what do we learn from all of these Don Walkers that we've been looking at? Let me wind it up this way, because I think this is the main thing I'd like for us to get. Very few of us will ever be a star. There's probably not a star in this auditorium tonight. When I first saw these two side screens, I thought, man, I might be a star because I'm going to be all over this place. But talking seriously, we're not stars. And we're not likely ever to be. Most of us have very small roles. We're just nobodies. In comparison to Noah, Abraham, Moses, David, Joshua, Peter, Paul, Timothy, and you can name a lot of the stars. We're nobodies who enter the scene to help set up an action, to provide a prop that helps the action proceed, or to provide a place where things can happen, and that's our role. It's not big. It won't get our name on some marquee someplace. And it certainly will not get our name written in the Scriptures. But that's where we fit in. The bit players, the small roles, the Don Walkers, the nobodies. So we walk center stage, we say our line, we produce our prop, we provide a place, and then we probably not heard from again. The stars take over, and the big things happen that God had planned to happen. But though we are not stars, and likely never to be, the point is that you and I, as the Don Walkers of Scripture, can have a significant impact on the lives of other people. It may be on our children. It may be on our grandchildren, our friends, somebody we work with. I mean, you could make that list as well as I could. But because of who we are, where we are, our determination to serve the Lord with all of our heart, we impact people. We impact people. No monument built to us, no day on the calendar to celebrate us, but God knows. He sees. And He sees you and me walking in and doing our one thing and perhaps walking off so that so many other things can get the attention. We're insignificant actors in that sense. Nameless nobodies on the stage of this world, simply trying to scratch out our pleasant, simple parts in the work of heaven. And what more could we want? Because that puts us in elite company. With so many we read about throughout the Scriptures, that God used him, God used her, God used them. And look, they did the significant thing that helped the story unfold and the plan of God to be accomplished. Well, I remember that day that Mrs. Lummis said, "Royce, I want you to open and close the curtain." I really didn't like her. So we got to that day and I opened the curtain and I just stood there until the play was over. And then I closed the curtain and that was my part. And as badly as I felt about that, I came to realize, of course, what was it David said? He'd rather be the doorkeeper in the house of his Lord than to be some great, big, important something else. I think I learned a great lesson after I took the time to think about it. How many times is it that the Lord needs someone to pull back the curtain in somebody's life so that they can see or hear or experience or understand? And if that's me, if I can open that curtain, if it's you, if you can open that curtain for somebody, how great a thing is that? Let me close with one illustration. I remember Hope and I moved here to join the FC faculty back in the fall of 89, I think it was. When we were students here, way back in, let's see, can anybody remember back in the mid-60s? We had our 2 years at FC and we worshiped over in Brandon, just a small group over there. We'd ride over often with Brother Cope. But it was a small group, but a real friendly group. And so every once in a while we would get invited, you know, over to somebody's house to eat. And I remember a Saturday, Hope and I were invited over and Brother Miller told us that he was going to make some barbecue chicken. Well, I could not wait. Because I was a faithful college student, I griped about the cafeteria food like you're supposed to. And so we pulled up into the Miller's driveway and you could smell the chicken. Oh, it was wonderful. So we got out of the car and was heading for the door and were interrupted by this little, I think she was about 5 years old. Her name was Karen Miller. And she was outside waiting for Hope and me to get there. So she runs up to us holding a little Dixie cup. And she says, "Royce and Hope, Royce and Hope, I've just been waiting. I wanted to show you this. I didn't want to be messed with. I wanted to get to the chicken. But my mama had taught me." So I said, "Oh, okay, what is it?" So she holds up the little Dixie cup. And apparently a little baby bird had fallen out of the nest and she had found it and put some straw in the cup and scooped up the baby bird. And so, I don't know, I said something to her, I have no idea what, and dismissed her, and we went in for the chicken. Well, that was way back in 60s, probably the spring of 66. Fast forward 23 years, and we moved to Tampa to join the faculty. And in my first spring semester, which would have been spring of 90, I was supposed to hold a meeting at that church. So I went Sunday through Friday. Thursday night, I was standing in the lobby, and they had these big glass doors there, and I looked at my watch, and it was 7:29. And so I was telling myself, okay, I got to go down and take a seat. And just as I started to, I happened to look through the door, and here comes this tall, red-headed woman running up the sidewalk. She bursts through the door, runs up to me, and grabs me, and gives me a great big bear hug. And all I knew was that she had the face of a miller. So I knew she had to be a miller. And she said, "You probably don't know who I am, but I remember the day you and Hope came to my house and you paid attention to me and a little baby bird that I had in a Dixie cup. And ever since that day, all my life, I've wanted to grow up and be just like Royce and Hope. And you could have knocked me over with any of the lightest thing you can imagine." I had no memory of that. That event was not important to me. But man, what an impact it made on that little 5-year-old girl. I could never have planned it. I certainly wasn't in the frame of mind to think about it. Oh, here's a 5-year-old girl. I've got to impact her life, you know. No, nothing like that. And isn't that the way life works for Christians? You don't plan the great things that happen the way we touch the lives of other people. It just happens. And some of the most insignificant things in our mind are some of the most significant things in the lives of others. That comes from just saying something, patting some 5-year-old on the head, making him or her feel good. We're nobodies, folks, but nobodies who play a tremendous role in this world of representing the Lord just by being Christ-like every day to whoever it is that shows up with a Dixie cup and says, "Look at this." You can't plan the greatness, but God knows and God sees, and God can make wonderful things happen when we just make ourselves available to Him. Significant nobodies. That's who we are. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Royce. Our children will be back in here in just a moment. I wanted to thank you for having an excellent presentation that could overcome our problems with our audio visual tonight. We took a power surge Sunday night that apparently we're still having problems with. And I'll take the blame for his charts not looking just right. I went over them today in my office, but did not try them on this computer. Sometimes in transition, they don't work out exactly right. But a wonderful presentation. We're grateful to you, Royce, for the effort and for coming and presenting this to us tonight. We'll break here for a couple of minutes till everyone else is back in here, and then we'll finish. Well, good evening to all again. Glad to have our children back in with us, and I know they've had excellent Bible classes. We've had an excellent lesson from Brother Royce Chandler tonight, and thankful he and Hope are with us. Eric's going to lead us in a song. Brother Chandler will extend our Lord's invitation. We'll have an invitation song and then close after that. But let's sing as Eric leads us.
Go ahead and mark your song book at song number 263. 263, that'll be the song we commonly call the song of invitation after some comments by Brother Royce Chandler this evening. And then if you would, get out your supplemental song book, song number 72. Numbers are down a little bit. It's the rainy weather and summer, so a lot of ours could not be here because of the weather, and some are out of town. So let's all sing out as we sing songs of praise to God. Hilltops of Glory, number 72.
Onward rejoicing, I tread my way. I hear, I find me in passing day. Hilltops of glory, now rise in view. Where all shall be made new. Hilltops of glory, I now can see.
Okay. We were winding up a trip to Columbia. We've been there a couple of weeks, something like that. And on a Sunday afternoon, I think it was, all of the folks got together in somebody's backyard for what we would call a cookout. I won't describe the nature of some of those things, but we were just sort of standing around in a big place, no chairs, no place to sit, except I did spot a log that was laying down. It had been cut off, so... As I spotted the log, there was also one of the young Christians there. His name was Santiago. He had been a Christian for about a year, I think, but a very diligent, dedicated student of the Bible. Well, I knew very little Spanish at the time, almost none, and he knew no English. So we both sat down on the log. And a minute passed, and nobody said anything, so I began to feel very uneasy and uncomfortable. Well, I don't want him to think I'm stuck up or something like that, so I have to say something. So I finally figured out a phrase I could say in Spanish. And so what I asked him was, the first thing that popped into my head, well, Santi, do you have a girlfriend? And he turned his head sharply to me and looked me right in the eye, and he said, oh, no, brother. First holiness, then a girlfriend. And I said, well, yeah, that's the way I figured, you know. But I've never forgotten that because, I mean, he was in complete earnest. That's where his heart was. First, holiness. And then, not just a girlfriend, but then everything else about his life. But first, holiness. To be separated out from the world, dedicated to God. That filled his mind every day, it filled his heart, and it filled his motive to devour the scriptures. And he became a tremendous teacher for a number of years. I don't know where your heart is tonight. Maybe you're thinking somewhat similarly, at least to the point that you know you really need to obey Jesus Christ. And then, separating yourself out of the world, dedicating yourself to him, then whatever else comes in your life. If you're ready to make that kind of commitment tonight, we invite you to come and let us know that's where your heart is while we stand and sing, please.
Affection.